Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the producer and host of today's podcast, and I'm pleased to have Jerry Gonzalez with me to discuss his book, In Search of the Mexican Beverly Hills, Latino Suburbanization in Postwar Los Angeles, published by Rutgers University Press in 2018. Dr. Jerry Gonzalez is Associate Professor of History at the University of Texas at San Antonio, where he teaches courses in Chicano and Latino history, the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, and metropolitan history. He is also the co-coordinator of the Mellon Humanities Pathways Program at UT San Antonio, which prepares the next generation of scholars of color to enter doctoral study. His research centers on the historical relationship between Latino identities and metropolitan places, specifically looking at suburbs as understudied sites for ethnic Mexican life, culture, and political action. Hello, Jerry, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hey, DJ. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, I was wondering if you could get us started today by just taking a few minutes and share with us a little bit about your personal and professional background.
Sure. I'd be happy to. So I'm from Southern California originally. I was born in Montebello, California, which is a suburb east of East LA. So you'll see a theme here. Grew up in La Habra, California, in Northern Orange County, a place that I'm sure you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And stretching way back, my family on my mother's side migrated to Southern California in 1914 during the middle of the Revolution. Sort of lived the whole, textbook Chicano family history. Ended up in Oxnard, picking sugar beets, and eventually made their way to Lincoln Heights. From Lincoln Heights, eventually, my grandmother got married, moved to Pico Rivera, lived in Los Nietos and unincorporated Whittier for a little while, and then back to Pico Rivera. So from there, my parents actually met in Pico Rivera at El Rancho High School. My father went off to Vietnam. My mother stuck around. When he returned from the war, they got married, rented a house out there in Pico for a little while, and then eventually moved to La Habra, where I was raised. So It's a little bit about my family background. As you can see, kind of spanning the 20th century and spanning the almost the whole terrain of Southern California.
Right. Tell us a little bit about, so how did you eventually decide to choose the historical profession and, become a professor?
That's a great question. I think initially I kind of stumbled into it. right out of high school, I wasn't the most stellar student. But I always had an aptitude for history, social studies, those materials. It was at Fullerton Community College where I started my undergrad, where I took a class with Jerry Padilla in ethnic studies. And I think that was the first real introduction to Latino history, to the history of people of color, to the history of marginalized folks in the United States. And that kind of got me flowing, if you will. It raised a lot of questions about where my family was in that past and where my community, broadly defined, was in that past, right? Mm-hmm. And, when I transferred to Cal State Fullerton, I started taking courses with Larry DeGraff, who, was one of the first historians to really focus on Black Los Angeles. And he offered me an opportunity to begin a research project where I served as a RA, going into the archives with him, sort of digging out materials around race and racialization in Los Angeles city politics. And this was really kind of a revolutionary experience for me because I was looking at stuff firsthand, things that that I felt that I'd missed in my K-12 education, to be sure, and and things that kind of confirmed what I was learning already in ethnic studies, but really like the material. So it provoked a more intense drive, if you will, to seek out this history, to do the primary research, and there I met Clark Davis, who Clark introduced me to sort of the canon of LA studies, in which case I ran across, or was introduced to George's book, Becoming Mexican American. He was giving a talk at Cal State Fullerton, and I made a point to, you know, to go to that talk, and I went up to speak with him afterwards, and he agreed to meet with me on campus at USC to discuss the doctoral program. And really, it was this, George's, sort of willingness to meet with me and talk with me and share his work and, sort of outline the program that, really sold me on, pursuing doctoral study, in particular working with him as a mentor. So he gave me the opportunity to do this. And, so that was something to me that always stood out about George and his mentorship.
Right. And how about the project itself? This, this book, it was part of your dissertation work. Is that right? And so how did you, what led you along the path to decide, hey, let's write a history of, Mexican-Americans, moving to the suburbs in greater East, East Los Angeles?
That also kind of happened over time. so really it was in George's LA, LA readings course, that I was introduced to Matt Garcia's book, A World of Its Own. And, I think that was the one book in particular that really sort of directed me towards the suburbs. I think at that point I was still, sort of toying around with, sort of smaller community studies. So I was doing some work on Lincoln Heights, really trying to figure out how East LA was going to figure into a dissertation topic.
Right.
And Matt's book for me just sort of blew open the doors. I said, I don't have to stay in East LA. I could actually move beyond it,
Right.
It made a lot of sense to me, just given the family history that I outlined at the outset, that, my family history didn't even, wasn't even confined to the boundaries of East LA.
Right.
And so it started, really got me thinking about the broader metropolitan landscape, with respect to Mexican American life. I was also fortunate to be at USC. The time that I was, there was a number of great scholars coming in. During my time there, the history department hired Bill Devereaux, and his work on LA is sort of canon, and he influenced my work in a lot of ways as well, around pursuing colonias as a starting point for suburbs. Certainly his chapter on Simon's Brickyard in his book Whitewashed Adobe was one that really helped me shape the origins of my book. So working with those folks, but then also working with my graduate colleagues, my graduate school colleagues. There's a really dynamic group of folks there at the time, many of whom were doing work on LA or some aspect of LA. And so we had a really great synergy, intellectual synergy around the site of LA, but the kinds of questions that we were raising around race and space and history and culture. And so it was just a really great moment in my academic career to be there at the time that I was.
Right. Definitely. Well, and when you think about LA and perhaps at that time when, you know, a lot of the stuff that you're reading, you know, about Los Angeles, there, outside of Matt's book, I mean, there really wasn't much, right? And even, I think up till, you know, even your book, there hasn't been many, if you will, you know, suburban histories, you know, that particularly focus on ethnic Mexicans or Mexican Americans. And in your introduction, you actually make the statement that, you know, the issue or the you know, the experience of Mexican American suburban homeownership disrupts that standard narrative, or as you put here, romanticized notions of post-war America. Can you explain a bit more about that? How is that this story in particular, focusing on ethnic Mexicans and Mexican Americans moving to the suburbs, how does that change what we, you know, think we knew about that post-war era of American history?
Sure. And I think you laid it out pretty well. I mean, a lot of the scholarship at the time was kind of biting around the edges. I think even in Chicano history, certainly Gil Gonzalez's book on the colonias in Orange County, Matt's book on Pomona, and Jose Alamillo's book on Riverside, to me, I think did really important work to getting us to the next step of the conversation, which was, you know, those spaces in between sort of the far-flung agricultural colonias and East LA, right? That there was this whole broad geography that sort of escaped the purview of Chicano scholars. At the same time that, you know, suburban historians, really the new suburban historians, right, were, you know, really changing the conversation around those suburbs, right? That, you know, Sam Bass Warner's conceptions of the streetcar suburb, or the, you know, the sort of wealthy, you know, enclave, weren't really didn't equal the universal narrative of suburbanization. So again, I think Nicolaides' work and Andy Weiss's work really helped me to see that not only in scholarly ways, but sort of in the popular mythology, that suburbs are far more diverse than they had been sort of portrayed in a number of different platforms. And so that kind of helped me to think about the ways that places like Pico Rivera or El Monte would figure or not figure in to the suburban sort of narrative, right? The canon of suburban studies. I think when I set out to do the research, I really started to focus on these local places. I'd go to the local libraries and check out sort of the booster literature that they had from the 1950s and 60s, and, you know, try to understand the ways that they packaged that mythology and those notions of the sort of ideal place. Well, at the same time, you know, using oral histories and digging through census records and through newspaper accounts, et cetera, of you know, the presence of ethnic Mexicans and the activities of ethnic Mexicans in these places that didn't quite jive with, you know, all the ideas that we held about suburbs. And so this was a kind of really important merger of scholarly fields, suburbs and Chicano history, particularly Chicano urban history. And, you know, joining up with, you know, the things that I had experienced in life, right? That, you know, I was traversing, you know, all these places almost on a daily basis as I drove back and forth between campus and my house back in La Habra. Mm-hmm. So,
right. And for me, it seems to the book itself, you know, does two, I think, really a number of neat things. And the first thing that we're talking about right here is the, you know, the disruption of that standard narrative that whether you've gone and studied, right, metropolitan or urban history, suburban history, all these different names, you know, in college or not, people are still really familiar with the major tropes and ideas that you know, of post-war America, right? That the suburbs are, you know, built in the post-war era. This, it's this, you know, expansive economic, right, era where wealth is being generated through home ownership, and that typically people of color are locked out of that, right? It's this, this notion develops of, right, you know, chocolate, so-called chocolate, you know, cities and, you know, vanilla suburbs, right, driven by white flight, white people fleeing urban areas to the suburbs, right? That's kind of like the main idea, I think, that a lot of people get that have read maybe a little bit about urban history. It's that dichotomy, right? You have, you know, people of color stuck in, you know, disadvantaged places in cities, and you have more affluent middle class whites that have fled to the suburbs for a number of reasons. Part of it's racism, economic opportunity, et cetera, et cetera. But as you just mentioned, you know, the you know, your own, not only your own lived experience, but also this scholarship of Chicano historians and Latino historians talking about Southern California start to really broaden that. And I think that your work takes this quite a step further, right? Because it focuses particularly, you know, particularly on that aspect of Mexican Americans that, you know, actually make that journey to the suburbs, right? And how different that was, right? For, you know, Anglos and whites, you know, and again, primarily in disrupting that major narrative and that dichotomy, or it's more of a paradigm, right? That whites were kind of the exclusive, you know, occupants, right, of the suburbs.
Yeah, no, and I think you laid it out beautifully. I think that's absolutely right. I also want to add to that that I think looking at the suburbs helps us complicate even that paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. That in, you know, in places like Pomona, for example, you know, Genevieve Carpio could tell you, you know, these places were just as highly segregated as, you know, Central Avenue or East Los Angeles, right? Right. And, you know, thinking about that kind of structural inequality across a broader landscape really helps us appreciate, you know, just how difficult people's lives were made by discrimination, if not, you know, outright lethal, mm-hmm. right? If you're crossing particular boundaries in some of these smaller places. And, you know, so I think there's a reason why that part of the paradigm, you know, is there. It holds up because it's reality. It was the reality. Mm-hmm. It's factual. Mm-hmm. But I think that we lost sort of this other sort of silent history of inclusion, right? That you know, that could really help us understand some of the internal politics of the community, particularly around some of the flashpoints of the 50s or the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, I think part of what my book does is not so much upend that paradigm as much as sort of nuance it or complicate
exactly.
it to a certain degree. That, you know, that there was a particular sort of ideal that many of these Mexican Americans had in their minds because they had lived in the United States for so long, right? Because at this point, they're, you know, by the 1950s, they're second or even third generation, you know, Mexican Americans, and they have a certain set of ideals that are shaped by life in the United States, right? To be bound by sort of the racial boundaries of LA was really a denial of their personhood, a denial of their place in a society that they and their families had literally shaped. So, you know, I felt that, you know, the activities that they took on, the you know, the sort of sleight of hand that they used in times to gain access to the suburbs was a really important history, something that hadn't necessarily been sort of explicitly written about, right?
Right.
And so that's what I was trying to do in that part of the book, yeah.
Right, and you explained that as you're just mentioning, getting at that nuance, right, of this you know, if we're, you know, distorted view of again, metropolitan expansion in post-war America, which creates these, you know, white and black, you know, dichotomies between urban and suburban space. You state that Mexican Americans, of course, you know, experienced the exclusion from the suburbs, but also, you know, they push for their own inclusion. So that's much of what the central story of this book is. This book is right. Mexican Americans themselves, you know, provide examples of both those that, you know, push for, you know, access to the suburbs, and their way were able to, through their, you know, their drive and, you know, various ways that you cover in the book, were able to get included into that suburban dream, that part of the American dream in suburban homeownership, but also were excluded. Could you, you know, take that a bit further and give us some examples, and in what ways were, do Mexican Americans thereby then present this kind of liminal space in suburban and, you know, post-war metropolitan history of being both excluded from that dream, but also at times gaining access to it?
Okay, sure. Yeah. And that was, you know, honestly, that was one of the most difficult negotiations in researching and writing the book, was trying to balance that very sort of a, I don't know, paradox really, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, at the same time that there is very overt forms of discrimination, particularly barring Mexican Americans from purchasing homes, that they were still doing it, right?
Right.
And that in these places, there were actually folks living there from, you know, who were, you know, sort of tied to the old colonias, the old working class neighborhoods that were linked to the dying agricultural industry, certainly by the 1950s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that was a challenge, because, you know, for most of the literature focused either, well, almost overwhelmingly on sort of the discriminatory aspect of it, right?
Exactly. And
so
right.
I didn't really have a model to sort of balance these very obvious contradictory you know, developments.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, there's a incident that I write about in, I want to say it's the third chapter, involving a high school fight between white students and ethnic Mexican students. And it happens at a high school, Pioneer High School, which is just on the other side of what is now the 605 freeway from Pico Rivera. So it's sort of in this unincorporated area of Whittier. And this happens in 1962, thereabout. And it's, to me, it was a reflection of just that very contradiction, that here you have, you know, this sort of growing number of Mexican Americans in these places, their children are going to the schools, right? And so in some capacity, you could read that as inclusion, right? That, you know, they're buying homes, they're making a community here.
Right.
But then you have these sort of really sort of violent, I don't know, hostilities directed at these youths. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, you have, and that's, you know, it's kind of a common story, something that we read in a lot of books, but one that I think helped me think through that contradiction, that, you know, just because they became suburban and just because they were able to negotiate the color line in a particular kind of way, you know, really in a way that most African Americans and Asian Americans couldn't at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that didn't equal equality, right?
No, sir.
And so I think, to me, that was, you know, that was just one of a number of important incidents that really brought that out, that contradictory position out.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of my own, you know, family history in ways, in that, you know, my grandparents, they migrated to post-war LA, or LA right about the time of the war, before, you know, before the end of the war, my aunt, from Colorado, that is. And, Both of them, this is on my father's side, my grandmother and my grandfather, were both college educated. I think it's like Adams State College. I think that's what it is now. I'm not sure what it was then. But, you know, they came to LA, and my grandmother and some of her sisters even worked, you know, in the aircraft industry as, you know, Rosie Riveters, et cetera. But anyways, the point I'm making here is that they themselves, at one point when they had accumulated enough money to want to buy a house, right, they ran into these barriers, right, these racially restrictive covenants and or, you know, these racist real estate agents that you discussed that, you know, would refuse to sell them a home outside of East LA. And they almost packed up and went back to Colorado because, you know, they just, you know, we're not going to have it, you know, right? We're not going to be denied that in some way. And I don't know all the details, they were actually able to end up buying a home in the San Fernando Valley out in Northridge, which in a neighborhood that had a lot of Jewish Americans, right? So my father, you know, when he tells me the story and tells me about his own experience growing up as a Valley boy in the San Fernando Valley in Northridge, has these aspects of, he tells me these stories of this kind of, you know, that liminal space of being included and excluded to where, you know, yeah, they were there and they were middle class in some way, in definitely ethnic Mexican middle class, right? But, you know, they would get all these what we now call microaggressions or just blatantly, you know, racist statements or treatment by school administrators and sometimes from other kids. But from my dad's telling, it was more from the school administrator's side of it as he went through, you know, the schooling system out there. That, you know, it's always kind of marked him, you know, as an outsider and something that he couldn't get, right? Because he knew nothing but growing up, you know, there in the Valley. And then at the same time, when he got older and you know, his older brother, my uncle, became kind of more active in the Chicano movement, they were seen as outsiders from, the East LA Chicano community, right? Because they were middle-class Valley kids. So, you know, they were neither really accepted, right, in the middle-class suburb where they were, but they had, they had attained that portion of the American dream, so-called, right? Because they had the house and
right.
My grandfather had a, you know, good middle-class job or a couple of them. And my grandmother was able to teach as well. But, you know, they're just kind of, you know, they stuck in that middle space, you know, the East LA boys kind of just saw them as, pochos. I don't think they probably used that word back then, but, you know, sellouts or whatever it was. They're just kind of stuck, caught in between. And so reading through your book kind of reminded me of that own part of my family history as you see that. And this, you just make this point, right, that even gaining the house itself didn't mean full inclusion. It was a limited, right, and reserve type of inclusion. Mm-hmm. And actually, as you explained, though, something that Mexican Americans had to force their way into, right? It took a lot of resiliency to get a lot of no's, right, in trying to buy a home, whether it was in LA County or Orange County, wherever it was, to finally, you know, find the inroad, right? And even then, it just, the path wasn't always, you know, uncertain and great.
So, in a lot of ways, navigating these racial boundaries, opened up new opportunities and access to, a growing number of Mexican Americans in the post-war period. At the same time, that it kind of left them open to some of those things that you were just describing, right? The, you know, kind of the questions of authenticity and, the risk of looking like a pocho, right, compared to folks who are maybe, more real or more authentic, right, from East Los, right? And, you know, I think that wasn't just, a family experience for you. I think there was something going on generationally at the time as well that even continued on to a certain extent, I think, that history, unless we've done the work around suburbs, is kind of lost, right? It just seems like a sort of a novel sort of intra-group tension or even a microaggression within the group, right? But I think there's something more there because there's a lot of work all being done on, let me walk that back. My friend Rosina has just written a great book about the Spanish language, right, and the politics of the Spanish language. There's an aspect of that at work in the public schools of Los Angeles and certainly across the country, particularly in the 1940s and 50s, where educators, school administrators, denied the children the ability to speak Spanish through corporal punishment, through sort of reprimand, through public humiliation, right? And so I think there was a whole generation of ethnic Mexicans who lost the Spanish language as a result of the things that were happening on a broader scale, right? And many of those folks are the ones who ended up moving to the suburbs, right? And so I think, there are all these things that are sort of happening on a broader scale that start to come down on people's individual identities and sort of personal experiences that, seem isolated, but I think are part of a much broader history.
Right. And one that you point out is moving alongside, right, these two histories, that is the urban experience, urban working class immigrant experience, that at this moment in the 50s and 60s, right, it's paralleling, right? It's going on simultaneously as you have the development of the suburbs. And so these new experiences of ethnic Mexicans moving to suburbs. And in the introduction, you cite some figures here, and I'm going to read them real quick. It says, you say here, okay, so beyond these areas, that's from, Watts, Compton, you start to talk about other parts of Los Angeles, that ethnic Mexicans carved out places of their own across the San Gabriel Valley. In the 1950s and 1960s, right, the decades associated with the height of suburban expansion, the numbers of Spanish surnamed residents in the San Gabriel Valley and Southeast Los Angeles County suburbs increased from approximately 20,000 to 180,000, right? And by comparison, when we look to East Los Angeles, that the population there, Spanish surnamed population, more than doubled, right? So roughly from 43,000 to 91,000. So you make the point here that while East Los Angeles is turning into the largest, Latino or ethnic Mexican barrio in the United States, at the same time, the largest suburban Latino population is also occurring, right, in greater Los Angeles here in the United States. So these two movements, and we've heard a lot, like you said, and we still need to do, as you're making point, there's a lot of great work that continues to come out on various aspects, of what's happening in barrios and colonias in the early to mid and even latter part throughout the 20th century, right? It's still much needed history. There's many stories that need to be told. But this part, which is not just, a suburban history, but as I think as you're connecting with Rosina's work, I also see them both as kind of like a middle class experience history, right, of ethnic Mexicans that we don't hear much of. So much of the experience has been narrated, rightly so, right, and told through that immigrant and working class history that it's at times just seems odd, right, when or even exceptional when we read or hear about Mexican Americans that were middle class or that are buying homes in the suburbs. But there's enough, right? The point is a large amount, as these statistics just clearly outlay, that there's many, many stories out there, much more history to be researched and written about to tell of this experience too, that developed alongside the one we know a good amount about.
Yeah, and I think that part of the point that I was trying to make there wasn't so much a criticism or a critique of the field as much as really a recognition that there's still so much work left to be done in the field, right? If we're doing metropolitan history well, then we're looking at sort of the connections from urban barrios to the suburbs or even to the exurbs, right? Like going beyond. I part of the work that I did was to show that some of the same things that motivated and inspired folks in places like Boyle Heights or East LA or Lincoln Heights were also motivating factors in places like San Gabriel and Pico and Whittier, right? So for instance, I can think of two examples here. One is something that we're all familiar with in Chicano history, and that's the story of the Zoot Suit Riots. So the concerns and the anxieties around racialized violence, particularly in this incident, are well captured. I mean, I think we have a number of good books, and certainly the references of the Zoot Suits can be found in most 20th century urban histories. But the work that I started stumbling across, or the research I started stumbling across with respect to the Zoot Suit Riots in the suburbs, I had never seen before, right? So, for instance, once the Naval Administration, sort of declares the city of LA off limits, the Zoot Suit Riots didn't necessarily stop because the city limits were barred. But what about the county? and so I write about this in the first chapter that that sailors started going into places like El Monte, right? Going through the barrios there and looking for Zoot Suiters, even as far as Monrovia out in the eastern San Gabriel Valley. And so there's a connection here that doesn't stop just at city boundaries or the definition between urban and suburban, but this is a broader sort of metropolitan threat to Mexican Americans at that point in time. The other sort of referent point is around questions of Chicano identity and Chicano activism, right? The 68 walkouts in these East Side schools are iconic, right? They're canon. But Chicano students were walking out in Rosemead and Pico too, right? And other places in the suburbs. And, I think that they're connected. Obviously, they're connected. But we don't know what the local concerns were of those kids in the suburbs, right? It's not LAUSD. We're looking at really localized school districts. And, I think there's still a lot of questions about those local concerns. And I think you actually address some of those questions in the work that you're doing, DJ. So I'm really looking forward to your book to help us understand those kinds of things, right? Because these institutions on a smaller scale probably have, a greater impact on a greater number of ethnic Mexicans over time than sort of the larger institutions like LAUSD.
Right. Well, I want to go with that metropolitan view that you're talking about too, because that's something that I think that really comes across well in the book, in that it's not just a view of course, Mexicans that move to the suburbs, but that there are Mexicans, ethnic Mexicans, Mexican Americans that have already lived there, some for generations, because LA expands into what were at the time, right, ethnic Mexican colonias or early Mexican settlements, right? So can you speak to a bit of the role, the very important role that colonias, Mexican colonias play in the suburbanization of Los Angeles?
Well, they were really the first ethnic Mexican suburbs, right? These are the places that are sort of scattered across the landscape, and many of these places just by virtue of being there become part of newer suburban developments. And so the first chapter I focus on a place called Hicks Camp in El Monte, and Hicks Camp has found its way into the scholarship in a number of ways. Matt Garcia writes about Hicks Camp, and Daniel Morales, who's at James Madison University right now, has written a really great essay on Hicks Camp. So there's some knowledge around this particular colonia, and actually there's a really great local historical society connected to the El Monte Barrios, and particularly around Hicks Camp. But I was looking at it, at this particular place, not as sort of an isolated community, as much as a community that was in the process of suburbanizing, right? That many of the challenges that Hicks Camp residents began to experience were associated with metropolitan growth, were associated with, hyper-policing, were associated with slum removal and eradication, right? And certainly the sort of post-war imperatives around land values and land sales. So many of the large-scale agricultural industrialists began to sell off massive plots of land to residential and commercial developers. When they did that, they were essentially foreclosing the economic livelihoods of many colonial residents throughout the Southland. And that altered pretty dramatically the lifeways of people who lived in the colonias. And so suburbs are really sort of drastically changing these places. And so Hicks Camp begins to experience these pressures and these tensions, from the Great Depression era all the way up through the 50s, when it's, for the most part, rezoned for a school and for residential development. And half the community is essentially eradicated, right? Bulldozed. And so, and the other half kind of sticks around. And this becomes true for most of the other colonias around the Southland, that parts of them are sort of nipped and tucked away. A place like Jimtown, for example, which isn't too far from there, is sort of on the border between Pico and Whittier, is essentially cut in half to make way for the 605 freeway. So these places kind of experience this upheaval and this destruction and removal. And smaller parts stick around, and people continue to live in those places, right? So when these new cities start to incorporate, for instance, Pico Rivera incorporates in 1958 as an independent municipality, they're incorporating already with about two or three really vibrant barrios, because those were the old ones, right? And, so that whole ideal that these suburbs are the exclusive domain of affluent and happy white families is only partly true, right? There's also this important diversity in these places, and one that's connected to LA as an agricultural region and LA as a suburbanizing region.
Yeah, and it connected to me, it reminded me of the kind of the earlier point you make that ties to this Mexican American and ethnic Mexican experience as kind of being, in ways paradigm shifting, because it's a liminal experience, right? It's a process of, you mentioned, we were discussing earlier, of inclusion and exclusion. And here, the attainment of, or the lack of attainment of suburban home ownership is an experience of migration and displacement, right? So you have colonial residents that are being displaced as a result of the building of the suburbs. As you just mentioned, their homes are being bulldozed and they are being removed. You have those that are able to somehow figure out how to stay, right? And some of it through their own advocacy and politics. And then you have others that migrate there. It kind of sounded to me a little bit, for the displacement aspect of it, as kind of a form of proto-gentrification. We talk a lot about gentrification right now, particularly in urban communities. In LA, we're talking about it in Boyle Heights and Highland Park, Lincoln Heights, etc.
Sure.
But this experience of displacement to me was just ringing so much, like a gentrifying experience in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think in some ways it was, but I also feel like there hasn't been enough attention focused on the role of the federal and state governments in suburban renewal. Right. So urban renewal is this process that we often associate with civic centers, and in LA, Chavez Ravine is iconic, right? There were hundreds, if not thousands, of Chavez ravines all across the country, and they were placed in the suburbs. And, you know, I referenced earlier the construction of the 605 freeway. That cut through, Jimtown, Flood Ranch, and there was one just south of there. It's dropping out of my head right now. But it cut through three really old and sort of prominent colonias, right? That was all about metropolitan development, right? Those are federal dollars coming in from the 56 Highway Act. So that's not necessarily gentrification. That's urban, well, suburban renewal. And you know, there are other historians who've made a similar point. Andrew Highsmith, Nathan Connolly have talked about suburban renewal, particularly with respect to African American experiences in Flint and Miami, respectively. But when we talk about urban renewal in Chicano communities, Mexican American communities, we often the first place we look is Chavez Ravine, right? And I think that Chavez Ravine gave folks across Los Angeles a reference point. I think it gave them a language to challenge urban renewal, but I think it was just the most prominent example of these communities being carved up. And so hopefully some smarter and more energetic historian will go back and recover all those mini Chavez ravines throughout Los Angeles and Orange County, et cetera, because I think there's a bigger story there.
Definitely. Well, I also want to touch, and I really appreciate your time. I want to get to two last quick questions. One regarding to the book, and then the next one about your future work. But regarding this book, you make the statement early on that this is very much a history about, right, the effect of suburban homeownership on Mexican American identity and politics. So can you discuss that a little bit? What type of effect, you know, did this have in, that is the accessing, a suburban home, mm-hmm. On, the development of ethnic Mexican identity and even political, mobilization?
Sure. That's a great question, because it is one of the points that I really do try to make in the book. home ownership connotes investment, right? There's not only it's a material investment, to be sure. There's questions of building equity. There's questions of building wealth, right? And part of the reasons why the denial of home ownership to people of color was so devastating is because it sort of led to compounding structural inequalities, right? Where folks who could buy into exclusive areas were basically guaranteed the compounding equity in their property, right? So, 5, 10, 15 years later down the road, they could sell that home for maybe 3 or 4 times what they bought it for. And, so there's a certain, material effect with that's tied to home ownership. But I think even beyond that, sort of beyond the transactional, and I think it was probably even more important for Mexican Americans, there's an investment of time and energy and resources in building a community. And, certainly home ownership wasn't new to Mexican Americans in sort of the post-war period in the suburbs. Folks had been buying homes in Boyle Heights. Folks had been buying homes in Moore Park, for example, right? And but I think the thrust of Mexican American homeowners into these places, sort of reoriented the communities in which they were going to invest their time and energy. And, for them, suburbs weren't devoid of a culture. They weren't devoid of a community. They were there, and they were there to be to to um, you know, to be sort of nurtured and developed. And I think for a lot of these folks who are moving into the suburbs, particularly the more middling to upwardly mobile Mexican Americans, they really applied their position, if you will, to you know, to seeing across the suburb for collective advancement, right? And I think I actually even use that term in the book somewhere. That you know, as they're sort of contributing to these suburban places, both economically and politically, they're also creating cultural ties with folks who had been living there for decades, right? So those old colonias that were sort of cleaved off and remained became really important cultural spaces for Mexican Americans across the suburb. The panaderias that were there were there because the colonial residents had created them. And so, you know, I think there was a, you know, that suburban homeownership really sort of just shifted where these communities would grow and develop. But it did so on a broader metropolitan scale. So folks aren't just connected to East LA anymore. They're connected across the metropolis, right? And so I think that, you know, that answers at least one part of the question, but I don't want to go on too long. Mm-hmm.
Certainly. Yeah, no. And we want everybody to read the book so they can read the book to get the rest of it too. Well, before we close, I also wanted to, this is almost fresh off the press. It's been out for a little while, but definitely 2018 publication. So I know it is very recent, which is great. And it's also very accessible. I want to do that. It's just a great book. I just, you know, used it in a graduate class, but I can definitely see this being used very well in undergraduate classes. And I'm sure a number of our recent listeners also will be interested, those even not associated with academia, and checking it out. But tell us a bit, what's the next project on the horizon? What else do we have to look forward to from you?
Okay. And thanks for the words, DJ. I appreciate that. So on the horizon, there are a couple of questions that remained for me, I think, coming out of the book phase, with respect to who some of these folks were and what they were doing on a broader scale. And, you know, I was kind of deliberate about not making this particular study transnational. I think partly because as a field, we've done a really good job of looking beyond the borders, really to sort of reimagine Latino identities. But we've done a less good job of looking beyond sort of geographic boundaries, local geographic boundaries, to look at those identities. And so I was kind of deliberate about that. But the question is there, and it's always kind of been there that I wanted to pursue. And that was really around transnational migrations and the ways that, you know, particularly after the 1960s, Latino migrants and even Mexican Americans in sort of transnational ways begin to remake these suburbs. And so one project I'm working on right now is tied to the Sister City program, which was a part of Eisenhower's People to People diplomacy program, right, in 1956. And that's where cities sort of take on a adopted city from some other country, if you will. It was like this program to combat communism, what have you. But it became a really popular program in the suburbs all across LA. It's kind of wild. If you go, even now, if you look at these like suburban cities, they'll have a sister cities link, and they'll tell, oh, we have a sister city here in Japan and one in Chile, etc. But I started to find a pretty interesting correlation with some of these suburbs that I write about in my book with, you know, sister city programs in small pueblitos in Mexico. And in one instance, I found that one of the Mexican Americans who brokered a sister city program with a pueblo in Mexico had family ties to that pueblo. So At the moment, it's a question that I'm rounding out, but I'm really interested in not just the migration of bodies, but the migration of ideas as well, and the ways that these suburbs are starting to become part of a broader transnational discussion around identity and in American public life. So that's one thing I'm working on. I'm also really, really in the early stages of working on some similar questions in San Antonio. So I'm LA native, but I'm now a San Antonio resident, and I'm really energized by the by the city here, and really the potential for telling some really complicated and important histories, particularly in the 20th century, right? David Montajano has written some great stuff on the Chicano movement here. We have some understanding of the origins of LULAC and those in that crowd. But I think for the most part, 20th century Latino history in San Antonio is kind of wide open. And so anybody listening, if you have a graduate student, send them over here. I mean, there's a number of dissertation topics waiting to be hatched. And at least one book project for a particular professor at UTSA. So, I'm just getting started on some of that material here.
Hey, well, thanks for sharing that. And thanks again for your time and taking the time to come and discuss your great new book. So, again, very excited about it, and encourage our listeners to grab a copy of it and check it out.
Great. Appreciate it, TJ. Thank you.